Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Thomas Best and Brendan Patrick. They'll be telling us about the Two-Headed Raptors art show. So tell me a little bit about the Two-Headed Raptors art show.
Well, the Two-Headed Raptor Show is going to be a show between me and Brendan in Oak Park, Michigan, at Studio 8700. It's going to feature our artwork, our original artwork, and it's going to be and we're going to do it in part to help with the awareness of cystic fibrosis. Proceeds will be going towards the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. It's going to be Saturday, January the 28th, from 7 to 1 a.m. Brendan and I have been buds pretty much our whole lives, and we just want to make awareness known. It's an important cause for the both of us.
So, what inspired the two of you to take up cystic fibrosis as the cause?
My name is Brendan Patrick, and I was actually born with cystic fibrosis, and I've been dealing with this illness my whole life. At the age of 26, I had to get a double lung transplant, and I'm just trying to be a little more active in the CF community, and it's time for me to give back more. So this is why we decided to donate all the proceeds of the door to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation.
So how are you going about spreading the word about this work?
I guess through my art, and right now I'm actually getting a documentary film about me. It's called Can't See, by the filmmakers that get super rad. So we've been working on that process, and I think just sharing my story is pretty much the best way I can share, you know, awareness of cystic fibrosis.
So if you could kind of give me a preview of what the documentary might entail as far as your story, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, I'm blind. I lost my vision at the age of 26 due to complications with all my CF. And cystic fibrosis is also known as CF. And right now, as a blind person, being an artist for my whole life, I've had to recreate how I paint. And this is kind of what this show is all about, is just showing off my artwork. And as being a blind person, I have to paint using raised texture as my outline, and I've brailled out all my paints. And also, I play music. I play in a band with Tom Bestie right here, and we're called The Wretched Sight. So, yeah, a lot of it is just kind of my experiences as a blind person dealing with cystic fibrosis and just my day-to-day struggles and just showing my life.
So, have there been any challenges in reinventing your art since the blindness set in?
Well, being blind, I think the hardest part is just kind of having to paint before I actually paint. I know that doesn't really make sense, but I have to envision my piece of artwork before I lay it on a canvas. So I'm basically painting inside of my head before I even approach the canvas. So it's kind of a multi-step process. And I use a puffy paint, which is intended for t-shirts, like a craft paint, as my outline for my pieces, and once it's raised, it's basically a coloring book, and I just paint in between the lines, or at least that's my intent.
So, in your time as an artist, what's been the greatest success that you've witnessed?
My greatest success? I think just getting the opportunity to show my work anywhere. I'm just honored that people are interested in my work, and people keep asking me to do shows in the Metro Detroit area. That's kind of the most surreal part about it, is that people care about my work.
So, to anyone who would say that a blind person can't necessarily be a painter or be an artist, how do you go about clearing up those myths and misconceptions?
Yeah, I think my work kind of speaks for itself. It's kind of funny doing artwork as a blind person. I know what it looks like, but I actually don't. And I think that's kind of an interesting concept, is just kind of hearing everybody's feedback at gallery shows and just their interpretation, because a lot of people see something in my work that I didn't necessarily intend to have in the work, or something that I don't necessarily see. I mean, I know what colors I put down on the canvas, but people can interpret it a different way also with their vision.
So, if you could send any message to the community about disabilities art and the need for it, what would you say?
I would say just keep doing it. I don't think my story is necessarily about my art. I think it's about my struggle and the fact that I just keep going and that I go on. It's not about me feeling bad for myself or feeling sorry for myself. It's about me doing it.
So, in terms of your CF, what's been the greatest coping mechanism? What's been the greatest support?
The greatest coping mechanism is actually having my friends and family around me. I have an amazing group of friends and an amazing support system. And, you know, without them, I don't know if I'd be able to get through it. And Tom is actually one of my best friends. And he's, you know, he helps me out a lot, like on a daily basis, whether it's just taking me running around or just getting me out of the house to go grab dinner. That's why it's an honor to do a show with him.
So, what are the next steps in preparation for the show?
I think just finishing up painting. What is it, though? We're still kind of gathering some volunteers, and we're still setting everything up. And I think just finishing our artwork for the show is the main point.
Kind of add to that, this is kind of our first solo like dual show here, so I guess promotion is definitely sort of new to me, at least. It's not so new to Brendan has done plenty of shows, but at least for the both of us, like, together, we'd really like to see a good turnout, and we invite everybody to come out to Studio at 8700 have a good time, look at some art, eat some pizza, you know, and have a good time.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you.
Of course. I love this story, folks, for the fact is, an artist should always be an artist, regardless of the condition or what we as a society expect an artist should be. They should be able to do this, this, and that. But the truth is, the only question in art that matters is, did it reach us? Did it affect us? Did it have an emotional response? And the fact that Brendan is taking his art and saying, I'm a blind person, but I can do it. I can just envision it in a way most people aren't necessarily familiar with. And having an art show really does bring this to the forefront. It's going to a great cause, raising awareness of cystic fibrosis. But the fact is, his story is really a work of art, you could say. Being a person with a disability, living in strength, living in dignity, and saying, I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to do what I believe I was born to do. This is what comes naturally to me, and I'm going to find a way to do it. That's what disability life is all about. It's about that adaptation. It's about taking that step, saying, I am capable. I can create something that can reach you just as much as any able-bodied person might. For to the person looking at a work of art, they're not necessarily going to know who did it, but they are going to say, this affected me. This moved me. This opened a place in my heart. And that's all art really is. An emotional awakening. And regardless of who brings it to the table or what their ability level is, it's still art. It is still creativity. The fact that Brendan described what it's like being a blind artist, being able to have that vision, that concept, and not letting the complication from his CF change the fact that he is an artist. That's what I think more people with disabilities need to recognize. That just because you acquire a condition or something happens doesn't mean your life is over. Doesn't mean you must give up the things you love. It simply means you may have to find an adaptation. But you might find the experience just as rewarding as it otherwise would have been. For an athlete with a disability, for example, they train, they push every day just as hard as an able-bodied athlete would. And they still put on a great game. They still get the same adrenaline rush being out there. They still have to challenge themselves to keep reaching better and better places. Same is true of an artist. Being satisfied with creating a good work of art might not necessarily be all that they aim for. To create a great work of art, their own vision of a masterpiece. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Have you ever thought about volunteering with CJAM FM? Why haven't you? Volunteering isn't limited to students. Anyone from the community can come into the station and start their very own program. All you need are a pair of headphones and the enthusiasm to learn. So get involved right here in your community with a topical spoken word show or music program where you choose the content. Email programcjam@gmail.com or come on down to the station. We're located on the University of Windsor campus in the basement of the CAW Student Center. Find out more information about how you can volunteer at cjam.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Thomas Bestie and Brendan Patrick. They were telling us about the Two-Headed Raptor Art Show. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Sally Bennett from the Alzheimer's Society. So tell me a little bit about the work of the Alzheimer's Society.
The Alzheimer's Society of Windsor and Essex County has been serving the community of Windsor and Essex for 36 years now, and we have a variety of programs that we offer to the community to assist persons with dementia, their partners in care, and the community as a whole, particularly those who work in the field of care for people with dementia. Those programs take many forms. On site here at our Walkerville location, our building is in Walkerville, right across from Walkerville High School. We have a day program that we run from Monday through Saturday. It's a social model program with a wellness component built in where persons with dementia can attend for the day and have a day away from home. And it's social, lots of interactive activities, social stimulation, lots of good food. And it's a long-standing program that we've had for many years. Also, for persons with dementia, we offer one-to-one in-home care, usually for 3 or 4 hours once a week, where the person with dementia has one of our care workers, our client support staff, attend to care for them, and it gives their partner in care, their caregiver, a much-needed break during that time. And education and awareness is such a big piece in the world of dementia. It's grown dramatically, and we've made great strides in the last two or three decades. So we have education and support programs for the person with dementia and also their partners in care. And that can be in a one-on-one format, a one-to-one counseling format, and also in group sessions also. So that's the majority of our training. We also have a public educator who goes out into the community, into hospitals, long-term care homes, rest and retirement homes, and educates care workers holding various positions in those settings about providing appropriate client-centered care for the persons with dementia. So she's in and out of the hospitals in Windsor and Essex and the many long-term care homes primarily. She also can attend coffee groups, the university, the college, St. Clair College, private colleges, high schools, sometimes elementary schools, ladies or men's social groups, you name it. She's happy to come and speak and talk about dementia and tailor the talk to their needs at that point in time.
So what are some of the greatest challenges concerning getting the word out about dementia and what it really means?
Well, that's a big question. A lot of people, the greatest challenges are educating the public in terms of what dementia is. Because dementia, as you might well know, is an umbrella term for a set of signs and symptoms, and there are over 50 different types of dementia, Alzheimer's being the most common one. Dementia of the Alzheimer type is generally present in about two-thirds of persons with dementia. So it's complex because it's hard science dealing with the brain that we're trying to relay that information to those of us who are lay people and not trained as scientists and physicians per se. And that remains a challenge 30, 40 years on in terms of the history of the Alzheimer's movement. But the other challenges very much are operational in terms of providing appropriate and needed care for people with dementia. And all of our programs currently are operating at complete capacity. So it's a matter of securing greater funding from the government. We are funded through the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care through the Erie St. Clair LHIN, Local Health Integration Network. And we also fundraise for about a third of our operating budget as well. So the greater securing of funds that we're able to put together, the more programs and services we can provide for people affected by dementia.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the society, have there been any successes that stand out for you?
Well, I've been with the Alzheimer's Society for 15 years, and as I mentioned at the top of our talk, we've been here serving the community of Windsor and Essex for 36 years. The growth of the organization is really quite remarkable. As the story goes, our founders, the late Mr. George Sims and the late Mrs. Marilyn Brown Skinner, both had spouses that at the time they suspected had dementia, and this was back in the early 80s. And there was no such entity as the Alzheimer's Society at that point in time. So they sat at a kitchen table, as the lore goes, and decided to apply for a government grant. And a small grant was secured, and a part-time staff member was hired, and education and support was started. Well, 36 years on, we have a staff team of 45 people working throughout Windsor and Essex County, a very capable board of directors, thousands of people who volunteered for us over the years, thousands of generous donors, personal donors, corporate labor donors in the community. We're a huge success story, and we are a public trust. The Alzheimer's Society is very much a public trust, and we are the community of Windsor-Essex, so we've come a long way. But at this 36-year juncture, what I would say is that we still have a long way to go. Dementia statistics are increasing about 5% a year. So the number of people with diagnosed dementia is increasing about 5% in Windsor-Essex on an annual basis, and we're really having a hard time keeping pace. Our government funding certainly isn't increasing 5% a year, and we have to keep on the fundraising from the generous community to keep the funds flowing in to care for our clients. So that's a huge success, just overall growth. The other one that really stands out is We appealed to the community between 2008 and 2011 for $1.1 million in capital fundraising so that we could secure our home. We have this lovely former St. Anne's Church. Has been the Alzheimer's Society since 2008, and we've been here almost a decade. And within a few years, during the height of the economic crisis and the recession, which hit Windsor-Essex particularly hard, as you're aware, during that time frame, the community stepped up to the plate with the $1.1 million, and we were able to pay off the mortgage within a 5 or 6 year period. We're in our home here, and we provide day program, education sessions, in a fully paid off, modest yet lovingly kept building here to serve the community, and that's our base. So we're very proud of the hundreds of individuals from Windsor and Essex that contributed to that success.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for awareness and the need to keep going forward as far as education, what would you say?
It's a very interesting question. What I would say is that dementia affects all of us. So if you don't have someone close to you affected by dementia or haven't, it doesn't mean that dementia doesn't or won't affect you. Because the statistics indicate that most of us will at some point in our lifetime be touched by dementia, whether it's we ourselves receiving a diagnosis, someone close to us in our families, close circle of friends or faith community, or neighbors, our colleagues in the workplace, most of us will be touched by dementia. So dementia and responsibility to care for people with dementia and be aware of what dementia is and how we can be a dementia-friendly community really are a collective responsibility for the entire community.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Wonderful.
When dementia affects a person, it's not simply a matter of the suffering they must endure, but for those around them, there's nothing more difficult than watching someone you love, someone you've known to be a strong, intelligent, capable person, going into a place where their mind is just operating in a different way. One of the key things about education is knowing there are alternative treatments. There are new advances being made. The fact is, we have to keep pushing forward. For things like dementia and Alzheimer's, there's something that we must work to make sure that the generation forthcoming is not still stuck in the same place that we are. The truth is, when you're talking with someone who has Alzheimer's or dementia, you never know what's really going to reach them. You might say something that triggers the right memory, might bring them back to a time and a place that they remember oh so fondly. Or you could tell them something that happened last week and they would have no memory. It's a very difficult thing, but the truth is, you do it for love. You do it because this is still a strong, intelligent, capable person, maybe locked away somewhere in the mind. But it's up to the medical researchers, and the volunteers, the people going forward, to make sure we find the key to bring these people out. Fact is, as the population ages, as new generations are formed, we can learn a very great deal from our elders and those who've lived a rich, full life. If we allow something like Alzheimer's or dementia to rule over these people's minds, that knowledge, that insight could be lost to us forever. And that's not something I want to see happen. It's not something we should allow to happen. Because the truth is, these conditions really are a terrible thing. But the fact is, the mind is the key in terms of disability life. It's all about where the mind is. You can take some steps with Alzheimer's and dementia. Keep yourself sharp. You can rail against it, and you might even be able to stave it off for some time. But the mind must be motivated. A person must recognize they do have people who love them, people who support them, people who care. Therefore, it's not all right to go and see that relative just once a year to make yourself feel better. Be there for them. Learn from them. Do what you can to keep their mind sharp, to keep their mind active. Be a part of their life. You might even learn something about your own. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HANDILINK, numeral 4, at gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. I'm a firm believer in the words, as long as there's life, there's hope. As long as a person is still with us, it is our place to do all we can for them. Now, the Alzheimer's Society, they've managed to accomplish, economically speaking, what many of us would consider impossible in this sort of economic climate. They have managed to stay afloat and expand their programs exponentially. That's what I love to see. Disability organizations who, despite hard times, are still receiving the kind of support they need. Because it speaks well of our society. It says, yeah, times are tough, but I still recognize these are valuable, intelligent, capable human beings, and I'm not going to turn my back on them no matter what. It's providing a future for the work that will ultimately give them a chance at a better, longer, happier, healthier life. Disability organizations, a great deal of them, rely solely on donations or grants, whatever they can cobble together. But they put their heart, they put their soul into this work. Why? Not just because it may have affected them directly or in a personal way, but because they understand. People with disabilities, regardless of how they think, move, breathe, see, no matter what the difference may be, they are still a part of this great tapestry we call life. And it's not our obligation to provide for them. It is our privilege to stand beside them, to give them the best quality of life, to say to them, yeah, things look tough sometimes, but we, the world, are not going to turn away from you. That's why I love hearing New Year plans for disability groups. They say to themselves, what we did in this past year was good, but how can we do even better? What great step forward can we take? And asking that question is the first step towards showing the real commitment to people with disabilities that we all need. We need to remember that a person with dementia is still a person. They may develop a cure tomorrow. They may not. But if they do, we should be in a position where we say to ourselves, I've been by this person all along. I always believed that they had potential, something to contribute, even if it's just a few good words. Remembering that, remembering people with disabilities can accomplish anything. It's just a question of how, is how we become a population that embraces true diversity. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks, and we'll see you next week.